You are listening to episode 237 of This is Type 1. Today we've got a cross-posted interview of me on the Type 1 in Midlife podcast with Melissa Slemp. Now, Melissa was a guest on the podcast here for episode 165, all the way back in October of 2022. Melissa had me on her podcast to talk more about self-sabotage and type 1 diabetes, and why it's important to know ourselves and give ourselves grace when we feel burnout and are at risk of sabotaging our management. So please enjoy this interview from Type 1 in Midlife.
Well, hello and welcome. I am so happy to be here with a fellow T1D. Colleen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is a treat. I have been on your podcast and we'll definitely talk more about This is Type 1, which is the name of your show. And I've been following you for years. I just kind of said something which was funny before we hit record. I love your sweet sarcasm.
Thank you.
Because it's fun, and you know, it's all sweet. Sweet makes a big difference because you know it just is.
It's loving sarcasm.
Yes, loving, and yeah, and that's. You know, I just love that. So it's really good. You know, with all the things we have to deal with, especially with T1D, we need to learn to laugh. So tell us a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself to our listeners. And if you want to dive into your diagnosis story, that would be good too. Share as much or as little as you want.
Sure. So my name is Colleen Mitchell. I like describing myself as an author, a life coach, a podcast host, a cat mom, a Ravenclaw, and a semi-compulsive hiker living in the Montana Rockies. So that's kind of like a 1 second spiel of who I am. But what's important for your listeners is that I have had type 1 diabetes for 28 years now. Mm. And as you said, I have my own podcast called This is Type 1, which we started in 2019. So we're just past 4 years now with that podcast. And I was diagnosed when I was 2 years old. So I don't remember anything about my diagnosis story. That would be a question for my mom, actually. And she probably doesn't remember the whole thing either. But what I remember from growing up, like the stories that I heard, was so my parents and my sister and I were all at a family friends get together type cookout thing. And for a few weeks or months leading up to that, I had been like wetting the bed, like peeing more than usual, losing weight, being lethargic, fatigued, like all of the classic symptoms of type 1 diabetes, drinking a lot of water, peeing a lot. Mm-hmm. And my mom's friend at that dinner noticed the symptoms and said that I should probably be taken to the hospital. Mm. And so that's what they did. And that was September of 1995. I have no idea how long we were in the hospital. I have no idea if I was ever in the honeymoon phase at all, but my diagnosis number was 544.
Okay.
That's basically what I remember about that.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. So how was it for you growing up? Again, late 90s. So mid 90s is when you were diagnosed. So there was a little bit more technology around when you were, you know, it's funny because the funny thing now is funny. Again, here's the humor that can definitely come into conversations like this. But, you know, if you're going to get diagnosed, now would be a good time with all of the tools, you know, because I don't know if you remember, I was diagnosed in 82 and we were still peeing on sticks back then. I mean, it was what it was, you know, it's all we knew. So what was the mid 90s? What was that like?
I mean, I'm kind of baffled looking back now, how my parents did it because I was two. I mean, I couldn't communicate with words, how I was feeling, what my blood sugar was, what everything meant. So my parents were champs. Mm-hmm. Like all of the credit to diabetes back then, they deserve all the credit and they were awesome at it. But like the things that stand out to me in my memory are the old Bear glucose meters that you had to unpeel the individual test strips from their little foil packets. And they took 30 seconds to read your blood sugar. Mm-hmm. And I had the actual Bear thing that went around the meter. So it wasn't just a B-A-Y-E-R meter. It was a bear meter with a bear on it. And that's just, I love that image. But what's funny about the foil packets is that when my mom moved a couple years ago, we found an unopened foil pack in the back of the studio where it had no business being. I'm like, how did you get there? They just end up everywhere, whether they're used or not. Test strips just end up everywhere.
That's true. Especially the used ones. Right. Yeah.
So I didn't have a CGM until 2015. I got my first insulin pump in 2002. So I think that was more the experience that I remember going forward was like, I've always remembered the insulin pumps because I was on one so early. But really, I cannot remember very well what it was like because that part of my life has just been obscured by having really good blood sugars and seeing it on the CGM and not having to do a logbook anymore. But that's, it's wild.
Kind of it sure is. Gosh. Yeah. I've been on a CGM for, I don't even know how long. I never thought about the year, probably 12, maybe plus years. I've always been on Dexcom. So
didn't their first one come out in 2007?
Maybe. I remember G3. I don't even know if there was a G1. I just remember G3. So, I don't even know what year that was. I was back in my corporate working days. I do remember that. It's funny how you get little bits and pieces of your history, but we don't always put all the timelines together. It's all good. So today's topic is something that spoke to me when I heard you speak into this topic is self-sabotage. And you kind of touched on it in one of your episodes. Mm-hmm. And just to back up to what you said, your podcast is about 4 years. It's been going about 4 years now. So what have you learned about yourself and living with diabetes since starting your podcast, or maybe, about all of us living, it's just that there's so many layers to it. Cause I've only been doing this since May. So, the time of this recording, I just started in May of 2023 and I've learned so much, not only about just the whole process of, producing a podcast, but all the different people I'm listening, I'm interviewing, and it's really been, so 4 years for you, I would be interesting to see what you've, been walking away with.
What stands out to me is, especially with all of our guests, is the breadth and width of all of their experiences and how different it is from mine. I would probably consider my diabetes experience to be relatively privileged because I've always been on corporate insurance. I've always had really, really good coverage. I've never had to ration insulin. Mm-hmm. I've never had to scramble to get my prescription to be filled when I ran out of like a 3-month supply of insulin. I've always had backups. Mm-hmm. I've always had extras, and I've always had a really good connection with the type 1 diabetes community. So when I started interviewing people and finding out that sometimes these people had been diagnosed as adults, which is becoming a lot more common. And not only had they been diagnosed as adults, they didn't know any other people with diabetes in their area. Mm-hmm. They'd never met in person another person with diabetes. And so it really, really brought home the importance of the community aspect of living with type 1 and just how much we can learn from all of each other from how different our experiences are. Yeah, and that really came together in earlier this year. I went to the Colorado Slipstream from Connected in Motion, which was my first ever adults only type 1 diabetes camp. And I highly recommend to everybody listening, if you can go to a Slipstream next year, do it because they are amazing. But it was just, it's so nice to just know that other people are out there with the same thing that you're dealing with, and they might be dealing with it in different ways, but we can all learn from each other.
Yeah, it really is a, there's obviously lots of, there's a handful of chronic disease and things that people have to manage, but type 1 diabetes is pretty unique because it's something we got to pay attention to. This is part of the self-sabotage topic too. We should be paying attention to it every day, but it doesn't go away. We can't take a vacation. Ideally, we can't. It's so unique. And I think that is the bond that I'm starting to learn too, just the different ages of diagnosis. It's blowing me away. How many people, specifically women, because that's generally my audience, of all ages are being diagnosed. It's no longer juvenile diabetes.
So like something that's important for both your audience and just anybody who's listening to this podcast or other podcasts is one thing that I found really interesting from my first few months of podcasting was that my A1C dropped like a stone to 5.0. And it had never been that low before. And I only found out after the fact from Rob Howe, who runs Diabetics Doing Things, that when you're involved with a diabetes community, it doesn't matter what that involvement looks like or how involved you are, your A1C is more likely to be lower than if you're not involved.
Oh, so, I like that. Yeah, yes. So, accountability. And it's just like you say, it's kind of indirect, direct.
Yeah.
But yeah, because it forces us to pay, you know, to be more closer, you know, to pay more attention, to be more in tuned. It does. It's like the conversations are more often where, you know, it's, you know, that makes a lot of sense. So community will lower your A1C. I love that.
Yeah.
Really good. Really good. So I'm going to give the definition of self-sabotage. Yes, let's get official with this, right? So it is, and this is not my own definition. This came straight from the website or I should say the Google search. So the act or habit of behaving in a way that interferes directly with one's own goals, well-being, relationships, et cetera. So these are examples, by comfort eating, procrastination, or lashing out at others. And another piece of this is to behave especially habitually or compulsively in a way that interferes directly with your own goals. So just like it explains, and your well-being. And, you know, today we're talking about how self-sabotage is related to living with type 1 diabetes. But like you have mentioned too, this is something that you help. So tell me the community and the circle that you really support people with self-sabotage on, and then we'll kind of apply it to the diabetes community too.
Sure. So I I'm certified as a life coach, and my life coaching practice is with people who write novels. Mm-hmm. So I work with authors to write their first drafts, to go from first draft to self-published or traditionally published. And we work on all the mindset issues that pop up along the way of figuring that process out, because writing a book is hard and publishing a book can be a lot harder. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the times I will, like for an example, I'll come across one of my authors who maybe hasn't written for 6 months because maybe they have had a really big problem with writer's block for that long. And so they might get to a point where they think, if I've been stuck for this long, like, am I going to be stuck like this forever? And so once they get into the swing of actually writing again, they're going to have that fear in the back of their head. And think that maybe it'll come back and maybe they can't write anymore, or it's if they experience the writer's block again, then it will be permanent. And I'm like, can we challenge that assumption for a bit? Because that's not true.
Yeah. It goes to show you how powerful our thoughts are.
Yes.
We can talk ourselves in and out of anything.
Yes. Yes. Our thoughts matter so much.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you see that this applies? And maybe like I mentioned on your show, This Is Type 1, this topic came up, and you, how did it kind of unfold when you, and I think it was with your co-host.
With
Jesse, that the two of you were, you know, because I'm usually talking with each other as a co-host. So yeah, I think the conversation was back and forth between the two of you. So what kind of examples can you? I've got a handful of them, and you know, the first one that comes to me, it comes to my mind is somebody who's and this can come at any age, even if you've been living with diabetes for a long time, it's the avoidance or the denial. I know when I was younger, I didn't know enough about diabetes to know how important it was. That's kind of scary, but I wasn't educated on the disease itself. So I downplayed it.
Okay.
So I guess in a sense, I was willingly downplaying it, but not really realizing how it was detrimental long-term, or it could have been. But you know, that's kind of an example, because it's, yeah, you know, when you don't know, you don't do anything.
Yeah. I think self-sabotage actually is really closely related to burnout. And that's something we talk a lot about in the diabetes community, is dealing with burnout, avoiding burnout, like getting around it, all those things. But when you're in a burnout mode, you are probably a lot more likely to self-sabotage. And that might look like ignoring your CGM or not giving insulin for the carbs that you know you just ate, or intentionally forgetting to pre-bolus or rage bolusing, which, you know, I'm 100% guilty of doing.
We all are. Yes. Yeah. Been there.
Right. But I mean, there's going to be certain like levels of self-sabotage that are higher than others. And you might find yourself doing it in a really tiny way, but once you recognize that you're doing it, that's when you can pull yourself back and question, like, what's the purpose of this? And do I actually want to be doing this?
Yeah. And do you think the typical person can recognize it in themselves, or
probably not?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because with us, obviously, we have a measuring tool, you know, it's that A1C, it's that time and range, all those things that we're looking at. So there, again, if we're paying attention and but we're cognizant of it,
the thing is, because we have those measuring tools, we then decide that we have proof now that we are not good at this. So if your A1C is high, if it's like in the 8-9% range, you're like, look, I have proof. I am a bad diabetic. Therefore, I shouldn't try. And so that is one part of self-sabotage, is you're not seeing the capability and the possibility of having a good life with diabetes.
Yeah.
And once you find the evidence, our brains will look for evidence of things we already believe. If you have that evidence on your CGM or at your doctor's office, it just reinforces that belief about yourself. And that can like keep the cycle going of self-sabotage.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good example. So why do we do it? That's the question. That's another deep question. I mean,
I know.
And I guess everybody's got a story though. And throughout our life, you know, I'm 41 years now with diabetes. And you know, I think for me, what happened was 10 years after poor control, I got diabetes retinopathy. That scared me like you wouldn't believe, you know, being told that I could go blind. So I did the flip opposite. I was so tight. I was having dangerous lows all for years. So I finally just, so in a sense that was, well, I was self-sabotaging my safety.
Yeah.
Based on fear.
Yeah.
And that took some time. That took some time to realize that it was okay to let go. I was going to be okay if my blood sugars were averaging a little higher. You know, it's all about looking at, you know, the pros and cons of what you're doing, why you're doing it. It's still a process though. I will say I still like in the back of my mind, even though the eyes are still checking out okay, I go every year for the annual. There's some assurance that I'm doing enough. And I think maybe that's part of it too. I think we need that validation that we're doing enough. We also need support from our medical team. That's another conversation. You know, we need that support So what do you think about that?
I mean, as for the question of why do we do it, I think it has to do with self-protection and safety. One of the brain's top three reasons for doing anything it does is to keep us safe. And if we're self-sabotaging, it might be because we're getting close to a place in our lives, and this could be in diabetes, it could be in any other part of your life, that feels unsafe because you're not familiar with it. So the first time I heard about this concept was in the book, The Big Leap by Gay Hendricks. And she talks about the upper limit problem, where we're hitting the ceiling of it's a ceiling of our capabilities, what we think we're able to do. And if we're bumping up against that and we feel unsafe because of it, we're more likely to self-sabotage to bring us back down to where that level of safety actually is. So with my writers, it's going to be reaching the point where they actually need to maybe send a manuscript to critique partners. So they need to have somebody else read their story, and they might end up not doing that and just keep reworking chapter one or the whole book over and over again because they're afraid of receiving that feedback on their chapters. With diabetics, it might be we're getting really good control. And so that's a signal to the brain that we're not good at good control. Let's sabotage that and have a day of bad control to reinforce the belief that we're not good at this and we don't deserve to have good blood sugars.
Gosh, that's a vicious circle. Right. Yeah. So long term, and I'm probably jumping ahead here. So what's the consequences? Other, you know, obviously, you know, health complications, like I was mentioning with my retinopathy. But is it like, and I'll use examples of people that I've worked with. This is why this topic really kind of resonated with me, is because I never, I guess I've never put the label of self-sabotage, you know, I'm not, you know, it's just not something that I thought about on that, in that kind of scheme or of what it was that they were going through, why they were going through it. But you brought up a really good point that, it's that known zone. It's what they're familiar with, even if it's good or bad. I mean, there's no good or bad. It's just, this is what I know. So I'm going to stay with what I know, getting outside the comfort zone. I know people and clients that I've worked with, whether it's, you know, the fear of lows is a really good example, where they will keep the blood sugar. And it's something that they can manually do. I mean, you know, they can avoid taking the insulin. They can, you know, or miss dose, or, you know, whatever that looks like, to keep those levels higher, because that's their safe zone. That's what they can control.
And that, to me, would come from some kind of trauma response from a really bad experience with with a low blood sugar, which means that needs to be addressed with a therapist, with a counselor, with a coach. They need to work through that trauma so that the lows are not scary anymore.
Right. Yeah. It takes time. It does. Yeah. Yeah. I know I had Dr. Mark Heyman on here back in episode 4 or 5 when we first started. Yeah. He was a world of information. I know he's doing some continuing workshops on this topic. It's becoming more and more talked about, which is good. It's good that we're talking about it, you know, that people are admitting to it. I guess I'll say admitting to it, but they're talking about it. They're sharing, they're realizing that this is not, you know, this is not good long-term. So really good. And I was going to ask about getting help. And obviously that is a good point, but you know, just like what you were saying about community, how important it is, you know, to have that accountability, to have people in our lives that we can share, you know, these habits with, or these fears with, and kind of walk through that. And to realize that you're not alone either. It might even just be a nice little, it's interesting too, because it's like, I know I host a Diabetes Sisters Pods, which is a national organization. And you know, topics like this, they come up. You know, that's the number one thing that women want when they get together, is they just want to sit around with other women that can understand what they're talking about. It's so amazing. Yeah. And topics like this, and sometimes they go a little deeper, sometimes they don't, but it serves a purpose. And again, just like you say, it's bringing it out. It's recognizing it, it's having that conversation. So that's a big part of taking that first step.
I have another example of both consequences and like the helping part. So I went to diabetes camp as a kid for a total of 20 years from my first year as a camper to my last year as a counselor. But during the years that I was a camper, one of the things that they did at camp was diabetes education, which of course you have to do at camp. But what they did was basically indoctrinate me to believe that I could not survive without carbohydrates. And so I grew up eating carbs, gaining weight, having trouble losing weight. I have struggled with my weight since the fourth grade. That's like my clearest memory of being overweight was the fourth grade. And ever since then, I have had this really struggling relationship with my weight and with food and all that. And I tie it back to those educators at diabetes camp telling me that I could not live without without carbohydrates. So I was unintentionally sabotaging myself, both from believing them and from not trying any diet that had no carbs in it or low carbs in it. Okay. And I went through this cycle all the way through college, after college, until I got so sick of it that I just decided to go the entire opposite direction. And I tried low carb or keto for people who really want to know. Mm-hmm. And I had the best blood sugars of my life the very next day after I went that cold turkey. And that was the proof to me that I had been sabotaging myself. I had been listening to people who actually didn't know what was best for my body. And I needed to both help myself, advocate for myself, and search out people who knew more than I did about that diet. Mm-hmm. So one of the communities that I went to, and that was a really big help for me, was Reddit. There was a huge mm-hmm. Reddit keto community with other people with type 1 diabetes who had had success, who had lost weight. And that was where I turned to for help. But that was like a really big eye opener for me, was not realizing that I had to, you know, think for myself, especially about my food and what I was putting mm-hmm. into my body. Mm-hmm. But it highlighted just how little real education we are getting about how food works for us as people with diabetes,
yeah.
and how different it's going to be. Because yeah. like somebody with type 1 might be able to eat a cup of rice and experience an okay spike with their blood sugar. Mm-hmm. If I even look at a piece of rice, my number goes high. So there's biodiversity there that they're not talking about. And that absolutely mm-hmm. will tie into our self-sabotage, because if we're not losing weight, if we're having bad blood sugars, and our doctors and our care teams are not giving us the right information, we can just keep going down a blind path without realizing it.
That's a really good point. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, we put them, you know, we look to them first, especially, you know, when we're first diagnosed or when we're teenagers or in our 20s. And yeah, to question it doesn't seem like it's right. But yeah, you bring up a big, huge point, and that's how different we all are. And it changes almost by the year, you know, depending on lifestyle, how much muscle you've got on your body, you know, all the factors that affect insulin sensitivity. And then, you know, just wait till you hit perimenopause and menopause, Colleen.
Not looking forward to it.
The point is to prepare yourself, you know, because now you know, okay, things are going to do some shifting. You know, it's all about having the right information and support to know. But that, you know, that's a really good point, that based on what we think we know or what we're being told, we can do some harmful. So do you still think that that's self-sabotage, or do you think it's kind of like, I don't know, kind of like induced? Because
it was self-sabotage to the point where I wasn't questioning it.
Mm.
I was taking their word for it. And since I went to college to be a mechanical engineer, part of that is questioning things. I was not using my engineer brain to question things that I had been told since childhood. But that's going to be the case no matter what. What we learn and what we're taught as kids is typically what sticks. And unless we are actually taught to question things, to question everything, we don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 To follow discernment. I'm using that word a lot, but, you know, to discern what you're hearing and what you're reading and what you're learning, and then to properly apply it back to yourself. It's real, real important. Yeah. What about certain, I wonder too, if it's certain personality types, you know, we hear about type A's that are more controlling.
I'm type A, in case nobody has guessed.
I'm not sure if I'm type A or not. I guess I'm somewhat of a control, but not like overboard. So maybe I'm like, I don't know, A minus sure. maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. But like maybe somebody that has the traits where they're a little more unorganized. So it's harder for them to focus on what's the proper treatment for themselves. And we can go back to dosing and having, you know, consistent eating plans and all that. Because as you and I both know, consistency really is key. Routine can be a bad word, but it sure does help when you're living with diabetes. It sure has helped me.
I will say that having a very consistent, like very predictable routine has helped me dial in my basal rate so that I have basically perfect blood sugars overnight.
I love it. Yeah.
Even if I have trash numbers all day, I can usually go to sleep and be fine in the morning.
Yes. And sleep is golden. So you can take care of the rest, right? Let's start with a good night's sleep. Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good example. But so what do you think about that when it comes to, you know, I still think it all comes back to like what you were saying, whether it's a situation, it's a feeling of lack of control. So you know, like, because diabetes is generally something we can't control. So if we
can, I think it's going to hit people who are more perfectionistic in nature worse, because they're going to be the ones who want to have 100% time in range all the time, which is not possible.
Take it
from people who have had it for 28 and 41 years. It's not possible to have 100% time in range at all times. It's, and the opposite side of that is, it's still perfectionism, but in that I don't think I can be perfect. And so therefore I'm not going to try. And those are going to be your people who have really low lows, really high highs. They seem to be on a roller coaster all the time. They may or may not be called brittle diabetics, just depending on what doctor defines brittle diabetes for them. But perfectionism is such a problem, especially in the social media world. If you're looking at social media all the time and you're only following the people who look like they have perfect lives with type 1 diabetes, you're going to end up feeling worse about yourself. And that's basically by design on social media.
It's kind of the all or nothing approach too, I think. That sort of mindset where, you know, you can't just settle on doing really well. So it's like people that do tend to self-sabotage are just, they're going extreme either way, you know? Yeah. It's really sad. Yeah. But you know, I'm glad we're talking about it. So this is good. Is there anything else that you can share that would help kind of equip those of us that, whether or not we're going through this now, maybe, I'm sure there's listeners that can you know, that this topic resonates with them and they're connecting to what we're talking about. What would you say the first thing to consider would be?
Well, I don't know if it's the first thing to consider, but it's what popped into my head when you were talking just then is instead of being really all or nothing, I have to have this 100% perfect or I can't. Think about the 80-20 rule. So there's Pareto's principle, which is you get 80% of your results from 20% of what you do. And this is seen all over the world through all different industries, through all different things in life. If you can focus on getting 80% time in range instead of 100, you will probably be much better off. And that extra 20% where you're not in range, it's probably not going to be that bad. Right. I mean, I've had some times where my blood sugar shoots up to like 350 and I feel like trash, and it goes down to 50 and I feel like trash. But the rest of the time, my number is in range and I feel okay. Those two excursions aren't going to define me as a person. And that's what I hang on to, is that the number is not a label. The number is not an identity. It is just a moment, a snapshot in time. Exactly. And that's what we need to remember.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, and that's really defining our life with diabetes. Yeah, we're definitely not defined by it. It's something we have to care for and to be mindful of, but we're so much more than just the blood sugar number.
Yes. And we all need to remember that. Yes. Especially when the blood sugars are bad.
Yes. Definitely have some grace with yourself. And do you have anything else that you could add as far as what, maybe think, just speaking from your own experience, because you were mentioning, how in your earlier days with the carbs. So how have you, where are you now with that sort of, mindset?
So, from when I started low carb to my lowest weight on that, way of eating was about 70 pounds, and then got COVID, you know, had a year of like not great stuff happen. And then I gained another 20 pounds back. And then I've just been sitting there since then. But my relationship with food has evolved over the years because I made that decision to go low carb. So now I'm not afraid of carbs. I will regularly, when I travel for work, and they have much better food where I travel to than where I live, I will regularly practice bolusing for higher carb meals and seeing how my blood sugar does. And the one that consistently messes me up, but I'm determined to figure it out, is Mediterranean food from one specific place in Centennial, Colorado. It's really good food.
Yes.
Mediterranean is my absolute favorite cuisine ever. And so trying to nail those insulin doses for the food is what my mission is right now. But I'm not scared of the carbs. And I think that's really important for people to understand, especially if you're going through like a food journey like I was, or if you're going through your journey to figure out what your blood sugars need to be. Yeah. Don't be scared of the carbs. Don't be scared of the lows. Don't be scared of the highs. I mean, they all suck at some point or another, but we can handle them. And once you get proof and experience with handling them, then you get better at doing it.
Yeah,
and exactly. If you don't believe that you can handle it, talk to a coach, talk to a therapist, and let them believe for you until you get to the place where you can.
Yeah. Definitely take those steps. Definitely. Yeah. Seeing and doing is believing. And the more that we can see the experience and, you know, my take too is when you get it dialed in and, you know, routine, there's that routine word again, but I'm a big fan of routine. And then that's not saying that I'm so tight with my schedule. You know, there's definitely weekends that we go out and, you know, there's glass of wine here and there. I'm not perfect by any means, but I find a way to balance it and have some fun and just kind of let go of the rest. And you know, the longer you're at this, because like I said, I've been at this a long time. I think I've learned, we learn our bodies too. Mm-hmm. You know, we learn just like you did as far as your association with carbs and how your body kind of processes them and utilizes them. It's important to be, you know, to be in tune with how your body responds. So that's another whole point of it too. Real, real important.
Along those lines, I figured out that if I eat dinner, my blood sugars are probably going to be trash overnight. And so part of my dialing in of my overnight basals was eliminating dinner from the equation. Oh. And so I basically do intermittent fasting every day because I don't really eat past 2 or 3 p.m. unless it's a special occasion or I'm traveling for work or stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. Again, you found what works for you. I love that.
Exactly.
That's important. It's important. And, you know, and I think another thing that we've really talked a lot about on this show is just our mindset about, you know, accepting our diabetes. I think that's another whole portion of this. We kind of tapped into it, but the mindset that, yes, I have this disease. As of now, it's not going anywhere. I can do the best I can every day to try hard, like you say, the 80-20 rule. And we got to let go of the rest. But the energy it takes fighting it and trying to resist it and avoid it leads to the burnout, causes more stress. And guess what that does? That's the cortisol. And then that's just going to rebound you. I mean, that's the vicious cycle too. And a lot of people don't necessarily realize that. And I think that's where the education comes in, is really understanding what they're doing, how they're responding, and how their blood sugar is responding.
Have you ever had an adrenaline high?
Well, yeah. But it's funny you say that.
Not like an adrenaline high, like you are like what you went bungee jumping or something, but your blood sugar goes high from the adrenaline.
I witnessed one. I don't think the only thing I've ever had any sort of cortisol, adrenaline, same thing. Is like extreme exercise. Again, CGMs will tell the story where it makes no sense, absolutely. But then suddenly, you know, your body is dumping that adrenaline, that cortisol. But I'll tell a short story. And this is kind of interesting. We were at I was at an airport here, getting ready to fly to Chicago. Actually, it was a Diabetes Sisters convention. This was like 5-6 years ago, with a fellow T1D. Her and I were traveling together, and we were sitting there and we heard over the speaker that our flight was canceled. So we're like, oh, okay. And of course, your first reaction is, yeah, you know, they'll have another flight. It'll just be an hour or two. They'll get us on another plane. No. And at that time, we were both sitting there. We both had our CGMs, and I was coasting. I don't know what my number was. I was 1-120, whatever the number was. She was at an okay level as well. And as soon as she heard that news, and then when they came and they said, no flights going today, and she was actually doing one of the presentations at the event, we witnessed her blood sugar just spiral out of control. It was so evident. And of course, it just all happened within 5 minutes. It was boom, 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 all this information. And then her having to just try to take it in, try to process it, make a plan. She ended up flying out of Jacksonville later that night. She still had to go. So yes, it does happen. So yeah, tell me your example.
Where I was going with that was, when you have an adrenaline high, mm-hmm. and you don't have experience with an adrenaline high before, and you bolus for it as if it's a real high, you're mm-hmm. going to have a really bad crash, because it will typically come back down by itself.
Mm-hmm. It sure does. It sure does. Yes, yes, yes. Your body will level out. Yeah. So basically what it's doing is that your liver is just dumping glycogen. You know, it's a safety, you know, it's a safety mechanism. It's taking care of you because it thinks that you're in danger. But yeah, generally speaking, it does come back down, especially if you have a good basal rate going. That sure helps.
Yes.
It's all about insulin on board. But yeah, good point. Really good point. Yeah. And yeah, it all comes down to just learning yourself. And I'm just recognizing this. Well, really good. This has been a great conversation. It's been nice talking with you, Colleen. Thanks for
Thank
coming
you.
On and sharing. Any last tidbits that you want to give our listeners?
I'm just going to say something that you already said, which is to give yourself grace.
Yeah.
Whenever we feel like we've messed up with our diabetes, when we feel like we've been bad diabetics, remember we can't go time travel and change what we had done before. So the solution is just to forgive ourselves for those past decisions and move forward from today, just doing the best we can. Yeah. And the best we can each day might not be the same. So the best for you today might be 10%. The best for you tomorrow might be 50%. The best for you next week might be 100%. It's going to vary from day to day.
Very nicely said. Yeah. Yeah. Just got to do the best we can, adjust, because that's what we do. We do a lot of adjusting and then we move on. So yeah, really good advice. Appreciate it. Well, tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you.
So if you want to follow any diabetes related stuff, then I'm on Instagram at @type1ravenclaw, and that's the number one. And then, of course, you can follow my podcast, which is called This Is Type One. And I'm guessing that Melissa will link to everything.
I will
in the show
link
notes.
Everything. You sure bet. Yeah, I will make everything real easy. And yeah, definitely follow you on your show. Again, this is Type One Podcast. And yeah, thanks again. I appreciate your time and come to talk about a real important topic. This is, you know, and we just touched on it. It's a topic that just needs to be mentioned and brought attention to.
Yeah.
And so that we can kind of look a little closer at, you know, what exactly we're doing and what we can try to do better and seek help. Don't be afraid to seek help. So thanks again, Colleen. We appreciate you. And all the listeners, let us know what you think. We always love your feedback. Bye for now.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation between me and Melissa on the Type 1 in Midlife podcast. If you want to check out more about Melissa or about her products, her offerings, her Abundant Health with Melissa program, or more about her podcast, please check out the show notes. And until next time, remember, you control your diabetes. It doesn't control you.